Since the early days of show business, drag queens have turned the status quo on its head by simply dressing up in women's clothing. A lot has happened since Charlie Chaplin girled it up in the early days of film. A queer revolution took place. Herman Munster became a drag queen for a day, RuPaul became supermodel to the world, and it seems just about everyone these days is a drag queen.
Today, comedian Frank DeCaro joins us to talk about his new book, Drag, Combing Through the Big Wigs of Show Business, which takes a look at the biggest names in drag, from long-gone queens of yore who sold out Broadway theaters, to interviews with contemporary cross-dressing legends like Lady Bunny and Coco Peru. Listen as we chat with Frank about some of the forgotten queens from yesteryear and how the divas stack up against their famous impersonators.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello?
Hello?
Frank, are you there?
Hello, Frank?
I'm trying. Are you? Can you?
You're popping in and out.
Are you over Wi-Fi?
Let's see what I can do here. It says poor connection. Let me go in the other room. Sorry about that.
That's okay. You're sounding better now.
Well, I'm going closer to the router where it's that.
Step into the light, Frank. Step into the light. No, run away from the light. Away from the light.
No. Okay. Whatever that little person tells me to do, I'll do in that movie. I'll do. Oh, she's dead now. From
Poltergeist. Tangina Behrens.
I thought she had died like years before she actually did die. Somebody's like, I'm in a movie with her. I'm like, she died 10 years ago. You can't be in a movie. She's like, no, she's still alive.
I know. I kill off people before it's their time too. You know,
Frank, I feel like I'm talking to you in the paranormal universe. Let me try calling you through another channel.
All right. Give it a shot. I'm here. Okay, and okay. I'll talk. Stop it. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show. Hello?
I didn't even know this could do this. This is thrilling.
Mr. DeCaro, paging Mr. DeCaro, are you there?
I'm in ladies' lingerie on 6. I'll be right down.
So. Oh, it's so good to talk to you. What?
Thank you. Did I do your show when I had the Dead Celebrity Cookbook, or did I just want to do your show when I had the Dead
You know,
Celebrity
I just found out that you actually had a book called the Dead Celebrity Cookbook, and I was like, how is it we've never talked to you before?
Yeah.
I think it was that I wanted to, and they didn't. Maybe they didn't make it work. I don't. Anyway, but I'm thrilled. Oh. I you guys are terrific, and I'm so happy to be getting to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure finally having you on the show, Frank. I'm so happy you're here. It's really great to have your amazing book.
Look at this thing.
Oh, thank
it's
you.
Big.
Drag combing through the big wigs of show business, and we got the biggest wig of them all. Frank DeCaro.
And we've had a lot of books about drag come through our way, and I got to tell you, this is one of the most fantastic ones I've ever seen. It's filled
one
with,
of, no, I'm only kidding.
No, I mean, no, it's probably the best one that we've ever gotten. So
there's some really shitty ones, I got to tell you, so the bar's real low.
But the interviews, you know, the pictures, everything's just fabulous.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It was a labor of love. And it's funny. I went and looked at my calendar because, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't know. I can never keep track of things. So I was like, when was that first lunch when the editor from Rizzoli came into LA and said, someone needs to write a book about drag and I think it should be you. And it was 5 years ago in March. And I was like, oh my God, because I was guessing three or 3.5. No, it was March was 5 years from this lunch. And people have been saying, they're like, well, did they tell you exactly what they wanted? And they were like, a book on drag. That's what they said. And then I just got in the sandbox and played. And I've been playing around for the last, you know, 3.5, 4 years really working on it. And the result is that beautiful book that they made. I mean, you know, you hand them your words and you hand them the photos you want them to use. And then they come back to you and you're like, this is pretty. It's, you know, it's like giving birth to a baby. And then you're happy that the baby, you know, looks like the cuter spouse, you know? So I'm glad.
You described writing the book as going on a diet.
Yes, I did. I have told that to people because somebody said, well, how do you do a whole book? You know, like, isn't it daunting? And I said, oh my God, it's totally daunting. If you think about, oh God, I have a book that's due. So you have to sort of say, well, I'll work on this Q&A with Lipsinka in the chapter that's about the three Charleses of drag. And then you break it down into teeny little pieces. And then you're like, I'll just do the Flip Wilson essay or the Sylvester essay or the Divine essay. And so you break it down like that. I always say it's like it's easier to lose 5 pounds 20 times than it is to lose 100 pounds.
Well, you could just get a PhD in drag with this book alone. I mean, piled high and deep, honey. This don't drop it on your foot.
Yeah, it's you get a lot for $18 on Amazon right now. You do get a lot for your money.
Now, for the people who are literally challenged, there's also an audiobook with Lady Bunny coming out.
Yes, May 21st it's coming.
And I was talking to her on the phone about it, and she said, I don't know why they wanted me to do that. I don't have the best voice, but I guess, he's a fan of mine. So I guess the entire book is read by Lady Bunny. Is that true?
I read all the me parts.
Oh.
And Lady Bunny read all the drag queen part.
So she's imitating like all the drag queens, or is she just doing it as Lady Bunny?
I don't know. I haven't heard it yet. I think she's doing it all as Lady Bunny.
This might be the most amazing work of audio art ever.
It could be a scream. She said she sounded like Bunny Vaccaro, meaning Brenda Vaccaro, because of the gasping and the scratchy voice and stuff. But I'll bet she did great. And your impression of Bunny was very good, by the way. But love that. I only had to read the me parts and not the drag queen parts, because it would be weird going, what inspired you to eat spray cheese out of a can while you were singing opera, Barla Jean Merman? And then I'd go, well, the first thing I wanted to do was I love cheese, or whatever. It was great to only have to do the interviewer parts for that. And then all the essay stuff I read myself.
Well, I got a clip of it actually here.
Uh-oh. Let's hear.
Here we go. So
I'm scared.
So here we're going to go here. Where does the urge to work blue and sometimes brown come from?
Who's asking?
So this is Frank DeCaro, and here's the clip.
Asking a question to who?
To Lady Bunny.
Oh.
And she goes, well, Jennifer Hudson can throw down with the best of the divas, but they don't make the beats like they used to. Bernie Sanders getting the stolen election from it again, but I love Raji Matera myself. However, Jennifer Hudson.
MSNBC.
MSNBC.
That was not what she said in my book. Anyway.
For those of you who follow her on Facebook, we'll get the joke.
I was delighted because I was delighted because Bunny said to me when we were finally going to do the interview, she was so busy. And then there was a time where she's like, I don't know if I want to talk about myself. I sound like I'm bragging. And anyway, I finally got her to actually do the interview. And she's like, I just took an edible. Let's start talking. And so we talked until she was incoherent.
You condensed all that into 2 pages.
Yeah, I did. Well, some of them you do have to take a machete to the Q&A to make it, as then what's going to last in a book form after we're all dead, so you do have to edit it a little bit, but I didn't say anything she didn't say. I said less than she said because it was easier to
Listen, I'm always editing down Lady Bunny from 3 hours to 2 hours, and it's like, and to me that you edited her down to like 20 minutes is really astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Who
you were like Daenerys and Daenerys? Game of Thrones. Just burned it all down.
But don't you adore her? I mean, really the thing about writing this drag book was it's kind of a thank you for me to them for decades of joy. Mm-hmm. I've seen almost, I'd say 90% of the people in this book.
Mm. Yeah.
I've seen live for one reason. If they're, unless they were 1912, it was Julian Eltinge. No, I was not there when he got his Broadway theater named after him in 1912. However, if it was, if it was on TV in the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s or now, I've seen it. And if it was someone I could have seen in my lifetime, the exceptions to that are a lot smaller than, a very small number. I've really seen a lot of these people. I always call myself drag hag number one. I mean, because I wasn't really sure I was the right person to do the book in the beginning. And then I started thinking about it, and I was like, I followed this career, I followed that career. And it dawned on me, I've loved drag since I was 3 or 4 years old. And I saw Herman Munster on The Munsters,
yes,
by Frankenstein, get hit by a bolt of electricity, and he wakes up a cocktail waitress. And it's like, he's the first trans character on television, I think. It was amazing, you know, and he got a job as a cocktail waitress the first day. And his wife says, don't let them get fresh, Ann Herman, you know. So, which I think is cute, you know, they don't let the men get fresh.
Lily,
so
yes, I remember
that. Was kind
that.
Of a nice thing, you know.
You know, Fred Gwynne and Al Lewis, who really created that show, they were vaudeville entertainers. And, you know, if you look at a lot of the pre-Hays Code movies of Charlie Chaplin, Fatty Arbuckle, they're all Abbott and Costello, the other one.
Laurel and Hardy.
They're all in drag and gay. You know, Laurel and Hardy's whole humor was that there was two grown men sleeping in the same bed together because they were too poor to be able to afford separate beds. And so they're always like, you know, putting their arms around each other and trying to hug each other in the middle of the night, and then cross dressing inevitably has to happen. And you know, the reason that we lost all that was because religious fundamentalists wanted to cancel drag culture because they felt that Hollywood was bringing immorality to the United States. And after pushing prohibition and stopping all alcohol sales across the United States, they wanted to do the same thing to Hollywood. And so that's why we lost so much drag from the early ages that didn't make it all the way until, you know, Herman Munster started doing it again.
Right. Hollywood does love a man in a dress, you know, and it's funny because, you know, they have those tropes where you get the hairiest, most manly, perhaps the ugliest guy you can think of. Put him in a dress and another straight guy will fall for him immediately. It's always, ooh, baby, ooh, you know.
Well, they're still doing it on Broadway with Tootsie, you know, all of a sudden,
yes,
you know.
I know.
Well, how do you think I found my husband? Now, let's go back in time. Back all the way back to young Frank DeCaro working in the New York Times by day, hanging out in the Pyramid Club at night.
It was New York Newsday, and I used to go to Rock and Roll Fag Bar and occasionally the Pyramid. But no, I wasn't really hanging out at the Pyramid. But I was going to Wigstock every year from about 88 on. So I was a big Wigstock lover, and I was wiggy and stocky, so it was perfect. And I got to watch all of that going on. But yeah, it is amazing to me that I could still get up and be at work at 9:30 in the morning after having been at Rock and Roll Fag Bar until 4.
That was the actual name of the place?
Yeah, Rock and Roll. It was at the club called The World, and the guy who organized it is featured in there. It was Dean Johnson, who I was listening to today, and he was from a group called Dean and the Weenies. And he was in the movie Mondo, New York, and he's fantastic. And anyway, but he used to have this party called Rock and Roll Fag Bar, and it was on Tuesdays. And so you'd go on a Tuesday night and you'd stay out till 4 in the morning, and you'd still make it to work on Wednesday by 9:30, which I cannot do now. But I used to do it in my 20s, and it was totally fun. So yeah, you'd see, you know, I mean, I remember seeing RuPaul in the crowd dancing, and she was still a brunette, and it was like, and she'd go, hey baby, and you know, you'd see her, and you know what, RuPaul, in, you know, that young, in a brunette wig, was still captivating, and you were like, oh, this is a super, you were in the midst of a superstar in 1988 at Rock and Roll Fag Bar, and you're dancing next to her to Half Breed by Cher at 2 in the morning. It really was the funnest thing, and you knew she was a star, and he's the grooviest. I just was on Watch What Happens Live with him, you know, the other night and last night. And it was fantastic.
With RuPaul.
Yes, there are pictures of me with, and Ru is holding my book.
Well, I know you're following Drag Race. Since you have RuPaul's ear, what'd you tell her? Silky Ganache doesn't make it all the way because I can't hear.
There was, and that would be what I would say, actually. But,
Silky, listen, lay off Silky.
The spoilers are out on Reddit already. They filmed the finale last
night. I don't want to know.
She used to work at a pizza parlor here in Boys Town in Chicago.
That's a good job for her. Anyway. Oh, that's just shady.
That is so shady.
Dr. Ganache is just, if I don't think you should be have a doctorate if you can't see the word colonel in a teleprompter and recognize it.
Well, she's not.
I know that it's spelled funny, but still, it's
she's technically not a doctor. She has a master's degree, but RuPaul likes
in
to.
In what?
I'm not sure.
Neither is whatever university gave it to
but
her.
You
I'm
know,
sure.
She's not a doctor, but she's also not a queen either. So I don't know why people get upset when they find out she's not a doctor.
Why is she? That's true. She's not a queen. I know. Her name is Steve, and she's not a queen at all. Yeah. No. It's. I can't imagine that she's. Well, I don't know. I like my doctors to be able to recognize all of the words in the teleprompter. You know, I do. That's important to me.
Frank, it's interesting because a lot of your early days in journalism and in entertainment and in club culture sort of revolve the idea of drag as a form of rebellion, as a form of sort of like pushing against the establishment. And a lot of the reasons that you have this book out now is because drag is in this really strange twilight zone where it's neither mainstream nor alternative anymore. It's neither one or the other. And it's like, Drag Race is one of the top reality TV shows. And there's people lining up paying $80 to meet somebody who, you know, was serving pizzas last year in Chicago. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, anybody like most drag entertainers are still hustling very hard. And even people who've been on Drag Race 4 or 5 years later are, you know, struggling as entertainers.
We're all hustling. Come on. Me, you, all of us, every drag.
You got to get a gimmick if you want
to. Yes. Everyone who's not in the 1% is hustling. We're all doing our thing, trying to make it happen. And, you know,
So have you seen a lot of change, or do you feel like it's kind of all still the same song and dance?
No, I think it's kind of amazing. When RuPaul when Drag Race wins the Emmy, a little show about men in dresses wins the Emmy over The Voice and Top Chef and other reality competition shows. That is a huge deal. That is astounding to me.
Yeah.
Now that said, the thing that people don't know is that cool people, the smart set, as they used to call them back before any of us were born, always sought out drag. I mean, it really is a thing that people looked for as entertainment and, and would go to whatever cool club they could go to in any part of the country. I was finding, in doing research for the drag book, I was finding things like ads for a 28-day stay in Fort Worth for a drag troupe, you know, and you're sort of like, wait a minute, it's 1958 and there's a 28-day run. A 28-day run for anything is a long time, you know? And the idea that you could have a drag show in Texas as opposed to San Francisco or New York is kind of amazing to me.
Well, it's cheap entertainment for the clubs because they don't have to do anything except, you know, play a song and throw a spotlight on.
Yeah, but these were like full shows. I'm talking about like a full, like, you know, a review, like the Turnabout Review. And it's a half a dozen performers. And, you know, the servers are women dressed as men and the men are on stage are dressed as women. You know, and it was like people would seek that out before any of us were born. So it's kind of amazing. And also, like I mentioned earlier, Julian Eltinge, I didn't know much about him, but I was interviewing Charles Bush in one of the first interviews I did for the book. Charles Bush wrote Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, Die Mommy Die, Psycho Beach Party, for people who don't know. So anyway, I was interviewing Charles and he mentioned that the grandmother of modern drag is Julian Eltinge. So you do some research. Julian Eltinge was given his own Broadway theater in 1912. He's a drag queen with a Broadway theater named after him in 1912. So 107 years ago, this drag queen is, you know, the bitch to be reckoned with. Okay. And I think that is something we have to remember at all times. It's sort of, now it's truly mainstream.
Well, and Julian Eltinge came from the vaudeville circuit.
Yes, but I mean, 1912, can you imagine 1912? And yes, he would defend his masculinity and say, I'm not a gay, I just like pearls, and all, you know, a lot of them would have quotes like that. I don't remember who exactly said that, but there was one saying, I'm not gay, I just like pearls. And I'll bet, yeah, I bet you do like a pearl necklace, you big closet case. However, it's fascinating to me that it all existed.
Frank, what was it?
As we like to say,
I heard rumors that you actually interviewed Divine shortly before her death.
Yes, I don't know how you know that, but yes, it's true. 9 days before Divine died, she played Detroit. And I had interviewed her and then went backstage and said hello. And I looked at her and I said to my friend who I went with, it was a guy that I had the hots for that never came across. Anyway, so what the things you remember. No, it was good. It's fine.
So you were trying to get to this guy and accidentally you started talking to Divine.
Well, we were backstage. Okay. And so I went backstage. But I came out of there and I said to him, I said, Divine does not look good. I said, we're gonna read that, you know, like she's dead. I said, this is terrible. You know, and she looked very heavy and out of breath and just that being standing up was a struggle, you know, and it didn't look like a drug thing. It just looked like, oh my God, I'm so fat.
We used to have this friend who was morbidly obese, a drag queen, and she got booked for one of our shows here in Chicago, and you had to walk up like a flight of stairs to do it, and she just screamed like, stairs! Nobody said there'd be stairs! I can't do this! There's stairs! And the poor dear, she spent about an hour going up those stairs only to find out there was an elevator in the building.
Oh, yeah, although that's funny now. A little party that's like, oh, that
she
was
died shortly thereafter too.
No, did she really die? Yes. Oh my God! Oh, now I feel guilty.
Death by Doritos. She was she committed suicide by binging on junk food, and she was diabetic. She went into a diabetic coma.
Oh, that's the worst story ever. And I have a dog who wants to talk during my interview. This is what I get.
But so with Divine, were you a fan of hers? Were you familiar
with
her?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was a fan since I got to college, and I had friends who were like,
hello.
You've seen? So they took me to see Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble and changed my life. I mean, it was astounding when I saw those. So, it was pretty amazing. And I was a huge fan. I've had dinner with John Waters and I've met him, you know, and I know people from that Dreamlanders group and stuff. So the whole book honestly was kind of like that. It was, I either knew the person or I knew how to get to them or I knew friends of theirs or colleagues of theirs. So that's why I don't really know why I was so like, I don't know if I'm the person. Cause it was like, oh geez, I do kind of know everybody.
Mm. Well, when you wrote this book, are all the interviews that you interviewed, they're all new, or did you kind of recycle some from your radio show from back in the day?
No, almost. I think there was one that I transcribed a radio interview, and that was it.
Okay.
What I really like about the book is that you pay a lot of tribute to famous drag artists who are known for their female impersonations. You know, like Randy Roberts, known for being Bette Midler. John Kelly as Joni Mitchell. Tommy Femi as Judy Garland. Chuck Sweeney as Miss Peggy Lee. You know, and part of it is like a lot. I think that's one of the major holes in a lot of people's knowledge. It's just these sort of like Provincetown,
New York,
the pink Chitlin circuit queens.
Well, that's a good way to put it. I think of female impersonation of like men portraying female celebrities. I think of that as the gateway drag. I do. I think that is the way you get into loving drag, because you're like, oh my God, he makes an amazing Judy Garland. And then you start liking that. And then suddenly you're ringside at a Bianca Del Rio show and, you know, you're screaming when she says the C word. So it's one leads to another. But when I was a kid, it was the gateway drag for me, because as mainstream as Here's Lucy with Lucille Ball, right? And the entire plot line would be Jim Bailey, who really was, he was a gender illusionist. He hated the words drag queen, gender illusionist. And he was on as Phyllis Diller. And the whole plot was Phyllis's plane couldn't land in California for whatever reason. So Jim Bailey has to do the benefit performance as Phyllis and no one will know the difference. That's the storyline. So it's like, basically you've got a female impersonator is you know, is what this entire episode is based on. And so, you know, you'd watch that as a kid, and then you'd watch, if you're an old kid, if you're old now, if you was, you know, I would watch The Streets of San Francisco, and John Davidson, who was a kind of a Disney song and dance man, very squeaky clean. He ended up being on Hollywood Squares, like a later iteration of Hollywood Squares.
You mean John Davidson of the John Davidson Show?
Sure. Yeah. The cute. Yeah. You know, cute.
The hunk. The Real People TV show.
That's exactly it.
John Davidson was a drag queen. I had no idea.
See, you get to a sort of a deranged looking Carol Channing impersonator. And that's him. He played a murderous, fractured personality on the streets of San Francisco. And she would perform as Carol Channing and then kill men with a hat pin to the heart. And that was the shtick. Because there was a lot of Norman Bates, psycho, split personality, drag stories when I was growing up. So that, anyway, but yeah, no, he was amazing. And it's really kind of the best performance he ever gave. He was really good.
You mentioned in some of the interviews with some of the celebrity impersonators, a lot of them would do the Ann Miller impersonations. Whatever happened to all the drag queens that did Ann Miller?
Oh, God, I don't even think people remember real Ann Miller at this point. I mean, you know, it's tough. It's scary how many people don't know stuff, mm-hmm. which actually was why I wrote this book. It really, it was sort of, I've had interns. When I was doing radio, we would have interns on, and I might as well have been speaking Mandarin Chinese because they knew nothing about what I was doing. Every word I said, they were like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Mm. And that's okay, but you need to have some intellectual curiosity. Because there's lots of stuff I don't know, but it's like, tell me about it. You know, I think that's my whole mission is sort of saying, if you think Drag Race was the beginning of drag, you need to know what was going on 100 years before it. And you know, so that's the shtick for me, or the impetus for me to make the book happen.
Who's the Ann Miller of today that, like, in 20 years from now, the drag queens will be like, Ann Miller who?
Oh, God, no, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. I really don't know. I don't know who will have that happen. Because you can't really. I never thought.
Step into the light, Caroline. We're losing you. Where are you? Right? Have you been walking? Hello.
I changed the rooms because the dog was barking so much. All right, I'm going back to the other room now.
Put the dog in the other in the bad room.
I thought Katy Perry would be. I kissed a girl, and that was the end of it.
We had Katy Perry scheduled to come on the podcast, and we were like all ready for it. And then her song hit number one, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
Whereas for you, like, you had sort of this like mainstream radio show that gained you access, you know, of course, your work with The Daily Show as well, gained you access
dozens
to a lot
fans.
Of these stars that a lot of these drag queens admired, and you've actually sort of got to know them pretty well. How do the, you know, so the you know, Bette Midler versus the Bette Midler impersonators, how do they compare to each other?
Well, I think Bette Midler is a Bette Midler impersonator, to be honest with you. I mean, she really is not the, she, we went one time, this blew my mind. Somebody said, come to, in our old neighborhood when I was living in New York City, and they were like, come to a friend's potluck. And we went to the friend's potluck, and they're like, there'll be some cool people there. Okay, great. And the elevator doors opened into the loft, and it was Bette Midler, Martin von Hasselberg, and little Sophie, because she was young then. It's, you know, ages ago. And Bette was carrying a covered dish. And it was just like, holy crap, it's Bette Midler with something she made. You know, and it was a potluck, and it's Bette Midler. But that person had nothing to do with the person who was on stage when you go see her, you know, the Bette Midler show or Diva, you know, Diva Las Vegas or whatever she's whatever show you're seeing her in. I mean, she is an impersonator in a way herself.
Wasn't there a drag queen that was trying to sue Bette Midler for stealing the mermaid in the wheelchair idea?
I remember Bette. Yeah. I know Bette was mad that Lady Gaga.
That's
did
what
that
was.
One.
But it was Jackie Curtis did.
Jackie Curtis started it,
but she was dead by the time.
Well, this is the thing. Like, we notice, like, said, Madonna gets mad for Lady Gaga stealing something, and the song "Express Yourself" is something that she took from somebody else.
I don't know. You know, there's a lot of homage, as we say. But yeah. I love when Bette said to Lady Gaga, "As long as I'm alive, the mermaid in a wheelchair is mine." You know. I love that. It's because it's the way it is, has to be that. So there's certain things like, nope, that's mine. You know, we all. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing with drag is so much about, you know, paying tribute to something or even, you know, mopping it.
Yeah, well, that's the idea of camp is you're paying homage, but you're kind of distancing yourself and looking at it. And we're all trying to understand camp, really, because of this big show at the Metropolitan Museum in New York and the Met Gala. And camp is the word everyone's trying to wrap their mind around. But it really is the notion of you know, you're kind of stealing it and twisting it. You know, it's kind of a weird moment.
It's being ridiculous for the sake of being ridiculous. Something with awful taste, but excellent execution.
Yeah, or something that's so dreadful. But it has to be earnest, though. There's a whole piece in the show. I saw the show the other day at the Met, and there's a whole thing about unintentional camp versus intentional camp. And most of what we're seeing on the run, on the red carpet there, but that was intentional camp. Unintentional camp is Showgirls, where it's like, you really thought this was going to be a good movie. It's the sexiest thing ever. And you're watching, you're like, oh my God, it's perfection. They really thought the Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest was going to be a serious biopic. And you're like, oh my God. But that doesn't mean it's not brilliant. You know, they're two of the finest films ever made because they're dreadful. Mm-hmm. You know, Showgirls and Mommy Dearest, you don't even blink during them. I mean, there's so much stuff after a certain age, you fall asleep during anything. You could fall asleep during Game of Thrones if you're old enough, you know. But Showgirls, you don't even blink. It's like you sit there and you're like, oh, my God. It's like, this is unbelievable.
You mentioned the Met Gala and camp. There's a lot of people online that are giving RuPaul a lot of flack for not showing up in drag for the Met Gala. What do you make of that?
Oh, too bad. Ru can do whatever she wants. You know, anybody can do whatever they want. You know what? Who cares what you think is the goal. The goal is who cares what you think. You gotta do what you want to do. What does she say? If unless they paying your bills, pay them bitches no mind. That's the story.
Well, they did buy a $10 RuPaul enamel pin at DragCon.
Yeah, there is that. No, I mean, you can have your opinion, but I don't think you should think you're going to change what anyone is, you know, you're not going to change what RuPaul is going to do because apparently it's working for him.
But it is interesting. Like the young generation of fans of RuPaul's Drag Race really are very isolated from the political maturity that people who sort of grown up in drag culture have. And you have a lot of young kids being like, very dismissive of somebody because of the way they look, not realizing that drag in essence is about celebrating the struggle of humanity. And when drag fails, it can also be wonderful, like unintentional camp.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I with RuPaul, if people are thinking if they're going to dismiss RuPaul, there's a t-shirt or a mug or a meme or a slogan that I love now. It says, underestimate me. That'll be fun. Okay. You know, that's kind of the way I feel with RuPaul. Underestimate her. That'll be fun.
Well, you've been an openly gay entertainer and journalist since
Pussy was a cat.
The electric bulb was invented. Yeah. And I imagine that you've faced some adversity and pushback for being so loud and proud.
In some ways it hands you your career, and in other ways it puts a ceiling on how far you can go. But you know, you can't complain too much. I'm still at it, and I've been doing it for 100 years, so it's fun. And but yeah, there are moments where you do. The one complaint I've always had is that we are still, after all these years, the gay man as every man still doesn't exist. And that's problematic to me. You know, you don't get to be the voice of men if you're gay. You know, you can't, the way a straight guy, particularly a straight white guy, gets to be the voice of all men. You know, you can
and
be
women.
Cast in that. And sure. But you know what I mean? You don't really, as a gay guy, you don't get to be the guy who is the late night talk show host. On NBC. You know, it's like you don't get to be that. You don't get Jimmy Fallon's job. You need to be the white frat boy to get that job, even in 2019. And that's still disconcerting to me. However, is it way better? Oh my God, it's ridiculously better than it used to be.
Now all the talk show hosts are getting into drag, and Jimmy Fallon's like, it be good, you know, and trying to get Cena in drag is, you know, my dick is confused.
John Cena in anything is John Cena in a washcloth is okay by me. Anything John Cena is, it's fine by me. I'm okay with that. And I do think having seen SNL last week, I'm back to the Jonas Brothers are so dreamy. And it's just, you know, you become a 16-year-old girl again. It's just ridiculous. It's, you know, you might 40 years were shaved off my life, and I suddenly was running around reading Tiger Beat going, they're so cute. You know, it's stupid. So, oh, well.
You and Jim Colucci, your husband, who's also an entertainment writer, you know, you guys are big, big fans of camp culture and queer. Yes.
Well, he is the New York Times bestselling author, Jim Colucci. That's what I tell people. His Golden Girls book, Golden Girls Forever, is a New York Times bestseller. Yeah, I know. He doesn't care about that. I care.
He's done two books about the Golden Girls, right?
Yeah. He did The Q Guide. And then he did this one for HarperCollins, Harper Design, 3 years ago that still sells. It is still selling really well. The other night it was number one in its category. We both were number one in our categories on Amazon. I did a little happy dance in my, you know, sitting there going, ah.
Somebody on social media was posting about the Golden Girls reunion and then posted a picture of three caskets.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, my.
Well, you got to actually hang out with and talk to quite a bit to Bea Arthur.
Oh, my God. She talked so dirty on her show. It was heaven. It was just a delight.
She talked a lot about her dick.
She told us to. How dirty can I be on your show?
You know, I have to say, because in researching it, every time you get interviewed by somebody, you always ask them, how dirty can you get?
Yeah, no, because B. Arthur did say on our show that Bill Macy, who is not William H. Macy, but Bill Macy, who played a different guy, who played her husband on Maude, was at an Emmy luncheon. And he ran up to the podium, dropped his pants, and screamed, cocksuckers of the world, unite! And so, B. Arthur told that story on our show. And so there is audio of B. Arthur saying, cocksuckers of the world, unite.
Did you guys have to bleep her?
No, when I'm on Sirius. No, we could say anything we wanted. So it was good. So no, we played, that became a bot, as we used to call it, where you just push the button and we used B. Arthur saying that for every reason we could think of. We played it constantly.
And so somebody said and responded that they wouldn't fuck them with B. Arthur's dick. Is that what it was? Or?
Oh, yeah. Jeffrey Ross, the insult comedian and the roast master, said about, he said he was talking about Sandra Bernhardt. He said, I wouldn't fuck her with B. Arthur's dick. And, and so later on that night, we were there that night that he said that, and B was on the panel. And so I had interviewed Bea, and she'd done one of my Daily Show specials back in the day. She appeared on this fake documentary about me that we did. And so I saw Bea, and I said, it's so great to see you again. I don't know if you remember me. She said, oh, of course I remember. And she said, I just saw you on TV the other night ripping someone a new one. And I said, oh, yeah, we did that review of that. This is back in the day. I said, we did that movie, that review of that Kevin Costner movie. And she said, well, at least you didn't say you wouldn't fuck him with my dick. And she walked off. And it was just like, oh, my God. Yeah, that was one of my great moments. But meanwhile, my husband got drunk. My husband got drunk with B. Arthur in her house. Okay, so writing the Golden Girls book. So that wins. He wins. My husband wins.
And was there ever temptation to be like, can I tag along?
No, I very rarely do that. I'm sort of, I get to meet enough people. Once in a while, I'm like, you can introduce me to so-and-so. But no, I'd met them all already.
Well, of all the drag queens that you've, and entertainers you've talked to over the years, I've imagined that you formed some close friendships with some of them.
No, I wouldn't say close. I mean, the only person if I've worked with them over a period of time, I mean, like, I'm friends with Liz Winstead, who created The Daily Show. And I'm
my bestie. She was just on the show last week.
She's my bud. We have a good time. And, you know, I'm friends with Lisa Lampanelli. I worked with her for the last 4 years. And so I'm genuine. I mean, that's, to me, it's like I'm friendly with people, but I don't hang out with them, you know. I'm very particular about that. Because when you meet people, like, oh, well, you're friends with someone. No, I'm not, and neither are you. You know, I'm friends with, just because you interviewed them or sat in their dressing room for 20 minutes doesn't mean you're friends with them. Okay. Do you call them in the middle of the night when something wrong happens? No, then you're not friends with them. Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Lady Bunny does call me in the middle of the night to say,
I'm sure,
I love squirrels. They are my friends. And then hangs up.
lucky you. I'm glad. And with the time difference from New York, I'll bet that's.
And I'm like, who the hell is that? I blocked that call.
No, I just, you know, I mean, but I'm friendly and I've gotten to meet, when I think about it, I've gotten to meet kind of, many of the giants of entertainment, or at least the ones I care about. And there's a lot of people who are if you're my age, if you're middle-aged or younger, I probably haven't met you, but I've sat with Elton John. I've sat with Bette Midler. I've sat with, I've kissed Lily Tomlin. Not really. But you know, it's like I've met Mel Brooks. I've met Carl Reiner. Sid Caesar, God, from the golden age of television. The handful. I sat with Robin Williams for an hour. I sat with Jonathan Winters for an hour. Right. You know. So I mean, it's like these people who are giants. I've been lucky enough to meet. You know, I went to Charles Nelson Reilly's house for a half a day because I was held hostage.
What do you mean you were held hostage?
Oh, it was hilarious. I thought we were going to do an hour interview. He came out in his nightshirt with his cap on and his scuffy slippers, and he made me lunch. He played me voicemail messages from Angie Dickinson. We watched a video together of this group that he thought was very talented, this musical group. We spent the whole day together, and I was supposed to be there an hour, but it was like I'm being held hostage by Charles Nelson Reilly. Wow. But it was heaven. Alan Sues from Laugh-In, who was a huge influence along with Charles Nelson Reilly. You know, I've hung out with Rip Taylor, all the major flamboyant icons I've kind of gotten to meet, other than Paul Lynde, who was my biggest influence in my life.
You're sounding like, what is it, Eartha Kitt in Monotonous. I've drank in champagne with the kings and queens. Monotonous.
I'm not monotonous. Believe me, I'm not bored with any of it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Eartha Kitt likes to brag about how the world is, you know, in love with her and hanging out with her. And then she's just like, yeah.
I'm not that guy. No one is more grateful or joyful about stuff, little things, than I am. And I always joke. I said, I should be selling shoes in a mall store in New Jersey going, I've got the same thing in a brown. I'll be there in a moment. 11D, I've got it. You know, that should be me.
I imagine that there, you know, as an entertainer, as a performer yourself, as you're working with these amazing people and getting to rub shoulders with these giants, at some point, have you ever doubted yourself or the opposite, sort of been frustrated with
your own? There's a lot of pinching yourself. There really is. You know, there's a lot of like, am I dreaming this? I mean, when I found out I was doing Watch What Happens Live, and I'd done it once before, but when I found out I was doing Watch What Happens Live, and then I was like, oh my God, this is great. And they're like, you know who the guests are going to be? And I was like, RuPaul. Oh my God, I love Ru. I've known Ru so long. I love Ru. And they're like, and who's the other guest? And they're like, Angelica Houston. And I was like, oh, you're shitting me. It's like, no way. You know, I mean, I worship Angelica Houston. I just love her. So it was just, my life, there's a lot of serendipity, you know, and I'm very, very lucky and grateful that stuff works out the way it. I have a husband. I have a dog. I occasionally a check. I went to the bank machine and put a check in today for which I almost forgot my PIN code because it's been so long since anybody paid me for anything. You know,
that's a good one.
But it was I got to do that today. I got sushi at the market. I mean, it's like, how bad could it be? Everything is good. People are like, boy, it must have been hard when your radio show was canceled. The first day of unemployment, I went to the Grammy Awards as Lisa Lampanelli's date, and she was nominated. How bad could it be if you're in a limo at 11 in the morning in your own tuxedo? How much complaining can you do? You can't.
True like, that.
Shut up. Your life is fantastic.
RuPaul has an expression that, you know, drag has an idea like there's windows for drag. Like it opens and it closes, and drag is popular and then it's not popular. Or it's in even more like on a personal sense for like a working drag queen. It's like you might want to do drag for a while and then you just stop and then you might bring it up again now. Where do you see drag now, and where do you like how open is this window, and is it going to get more open or is it going to get more closed?
I'm curious to see how it's going. I mean, I think it's you think, oh, it can't get any bigger, and then it kind of does, and you know, or more mainstream, because it's like you look at, I mean, how many different things are going on all at once. I mean, you've got drag, this sort of the transgressive subcultural stuff going on. You've got a new Wigstock documentary called Wig coming to HBO in June. You've got Tootsie is the toast of Broadway. RuPaul's Drag Race is such in the consciousness, and we're gearing up for the big finale to see who takes the crown. And, you know, so there's a lot of stuff going, and this book getting such love. I mean, I'm so lucky that people are adoring it. And then there's another book coming. My buddy Simon Doonan has a book coming in the fall, another book on drag. So, you know, it's like there's, it's kind of all continuing to go on and get bigger. And but yeah, what you were saying is funny. I didn't think that's where you were going with your question, because to me, it's like we all sort of ebb and flow. You have, mm-hmm. And they don't tell you that. It'd be nice if they told you that in college. You know, you'll have moments where you're, you know, you every fart is a gem, you know, and then you have other times where you can't get arrested and no one's interested in what you're selling. So you kind of have to just keep doing. Bruce said it on Watch What Happens Live the other night. It's basically you got to keep doing what you're doing. And ultimately, if you're still doing it, people are going to look up from what they're doing, and go, oh, you're really funny, or you're really this, or you're really talented or smart, or this book is great. You know, what have you been doing? It's like, well, there were four other books before this one, but it's okay that you didn't notice, you know, but you just kind of have to not be bitter and just keep doing your thing and never give up and look at the grand scheme of things. You know, do you have friends? Do you have a husband or a wife or somebody who likes you? Or, you know, I mean, does the dog not bite you when it sees you? It's like there's so much good stuff going on. And I, you know, I mean, I've always been a glass half full kind of guy. I mean, I always think my glass is chipped, you know, which pisses me off, but still,
but and it's full half full. Vodka.
You know, it's half full and yeah, I mean, no, it's more a milkshake probably, but it might be a spiked milkshake, but you know, it's my glass has always been half full. It's chipped, which is annoying, but still it's half full. So I just think to me, that's you have to kind of be glad for what's going on. And you know, I was gonna say, if I were still doing radio, I might have stayed 317 pounds and you could call me Dr. Ganache Light. I mean, I just, you know, I was fat, really heavy, but I lost the job. I had time to go to the gym. I had an intervention with Lisa Lampanelli, who said, you've got to lose weight. And I did. And so now I go to the gym and I can run.
Lisa Lampanelli had an intervention with you?
Because she had lost 107 pounds. Mm. And so she made me lose weight. And so I lost 105. And
wow.
But I wasn't going to do it I wasn't getting surgery. Because she scared me. She was like, she said, you either need to lose weight or get that surgery. And I was like, I'm not getting the surgery. I'm just going to lose the weight. And so I did. So yeah, so I go to the gym all the time and it's fun. And I could see my feet and I look better than I have in years.
Good for you.
You can breathe now when you see a flight of stairs. You don't scream.
Yes. Oh my, no, I was that. Okay, here's the big reveal. I was that drag queen who couldn't climb those stairs. I was terrified. I said a broken escalator was like reason to cry. And now you're just sort of like, oh Jesus, take the stairs. It's like, come on, let's move it, Mary. You know, and I do stuff and it's fun. I never thought, I mean, 4 years ago, I couldn't finish a 10-minute stress test. And now I can run 3.5 miles in 45 minutes. Which for a skinny person and a young person is not much, but for someone who's in his mid 50s who used to weigh 300 pounds, you see if you can be as old as I am and run 3.5 miles.
Congratulations.
What track are you running this at?
Oh, I do it on the treadmill and I listen to that band Sophie Tucker. I think they're so cute and I'm so glad I know someone young. So I listen to my Sophie Tucker compilation tape and not Sophie Tucker, the vaudevillian. Sophie Tucker, these two kids, Sophie and Tucker, but their group is called Sophie Tucker. And I love them. Mm. So I play them all the time.
You know, Barbara Walters named her memoirs Audition because she felt that despite all her success and years in journalism, that she was always having to audition in front of every single interview that she did. And every time she applied for a job, she was just trying to sort of like push back against that glass ceiling that she was facing.
She should have named her book, I Am So Witch. Okay. I'm very, very witch. I am so witch. I have so much money. I'm witch. I'm very witch. That's what she should have called her book. I'm very witch.
But you strike me as almost grateful. Like, you know, you don't feel like you had to push back against anything.
No, I mean, I feel like I had to work really hard and feel there have been times where I've been overlooked, but you know, a lot of stuff's gone my way too. I love that meme that says, you know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, but a lot of it really is. And I do feel that way. I mean, I'm bi-coastal. I'm married to someone we're together 23 years and we like each other more now than we did 23 years ago. What am I going to complain about? You know, it'd be nice. I wish more checks came. But other than that's a very small, I've knocked wood, I've got my health. It's like, that's a very small thing to complain about. It's like that. I don't make a lot of money, you know, right at this moment. It will be, it's like, it'll come again.
Well, I hope that we'll be able to sell some of your books for people, especially, I think the audio book with you and Lady Bunny is going to be a hit. We'll play some of it on the show.
What if it's really funny, like the two of us together? What if it doesn't go together and it's deranged and then it becomes, you know what, as long as it sells, that's all I
can. You know the Shags? Do you ever hear about this indie cult group called the Shags? It was like
three, oh yeah, they were cute. Yeah.
Three sisters and two of them were special needs, I believe, and the father was really aggressive about fulfilling his dream of being like a music producer, sort of like Joe Jackson and the Jackson 5, right?
Yeah. Well, Bunny and I are special needs, and we're almost three people standing next to each other, so that would be...
The album is that everybody loved it because the girls didn't listen to each other at all, and so when they were playing together, it sounded like they're in separate rooms.
Maybe that's what we'll sound like. I'm hoping this will have
that kind of quality of like, you know, movie phone kind of thing. Like, and now insert your answer.
So it can't be that we made like the Thriller of without the touching of the children. If we made the Thriller of audio recordings, we have to make the Shags. I'll take it. It's fine. That'll be good. But
the question is, who are parents? Parents are the ones.
Bonnie and I are old enough that we have to be our own parental units and our own driving forces.
Well, are you a drag dad for anybody out there?
I love my friend in Philly, Brittany Lynn, said to me. I quoted her because she said Frank DeCaro is the drag daddy we always wanted and needed. And I was like, that's so sweet. I don't know what that means. I have to do other than. Just, I mean, I'm a really good audience member and, you know, and I that's no joke. I really am a really good audience member because I don't sit there and act pissy about stuff unless I hate it. I mean, if there are moments where I hate stuff, it's true. But most of the time I'm like, that was fun. You know, if one thing is really good, I'm like, that's good. You know, and I like it. And then once in a while I'm blown away and I go out of my mind and I vibrate because I'm so excited how good it is. And, you know, honestly, I think that it's better to be someone that they say liker's gonna like. You know, I'm a liker. I like stuff and I like more stuff than I don't like. Yeah. If I really don't like it, it's problematic and I never shut up about how much I don't like something. You know? And it's like a restaurant and the food is really precious, especially that's a very close to home thing. I get very pissy if it's like white girl food. It's like if it's a sandwich that you like, you look under the plate for the rest of it. It's like, where the hell's the rest of the sandwich? This is it, you know. Then I get mad. Little portions do in anything. Figuratively speaking, little portions bother me. You know, I want a lot of everything, and you know, and so that's kind of my more is more is my mantra. You know, but I do. I think you should. You know, I'm a good audience member, and I'm very much a cheerleader for everyone who's in this book. And
I love how genuine and excited you are about every single creative endeavor you take. I think that's something that we need to see more of in this world.
It's fun. Why shouldn't you be that way? You know, it's funny. You get the older you get, the more you start thinking, like, what's your? You do. You ask yourself, what's your best feature? What, you know? And my enthusiasm for little things. My genuine, unbridled enthusiasm for little things. I have days where I'm completely depressed like anybody else, but there are moments of joy. It's like a perfect chocolate chip cookie makes that day Christmas morning, or at least that moment. It's Christmas morning and I'm 9 years old, you know, and Santa just delivered my favorite Batman toy. It's like I really can take huge pleasure in small things. I came to Chicago to do the Chicago Humanities Festival. I planned that trip that the moment I got off the plane, I threw my bags in the hotel and I walked to Giordano's. And I sat and diet be damned. I ate that friggin' stuffed pizza like there's no tomorrow. You could have sent me the moon and back and I wouldn't have been happier. It was the best night, you know? And I just have little moments where I wish that for everybody. I know it's not in everyone's makeup to be able to be that way, but I'm like a little kid. I really, little shits make me really happy. It's like the stupid little thing.
Well, Frank, like, next time you're in Chicago, we'll go. We'll take you to Lou Malnati's for a sausage.
I didn't like
mushroom.
It. Everyone likes Lou Malnati's, and I didn't like it. It's like I went once, and I was like, I'm going to Giordano's. I used to like Eduardo's. I don't know if Eduardo's still exists. When I was at Northwestern, we would get you'd get a spinach souffle pizza with sausage and pesto. Ooh. That was my favorite ever. And I don't know if they even exist anymore, but that was always fun. Then we'd go to Carmen's of Evans. I tried them all. I didn't get to be 300 pounds for no, without,
did you go to the
without having
club?
Fun all along the way. You
did
know?
You go to the gay clubs here in Chicago back in the day when you lived here?
Back in the day. Yes. I'm old enough at 2003 years old. I went to the Bistro, which there was just a book. Owen Keenan just did that amazing book about Dugan's Bistro and the Legend of the Bearded Lady.
We interviewed him.
That was great. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's great. So, but I went to the Bistro because I got to Northwestern, and freshman New Student Week, I fell in with a bunch of gays, and one of whom was Dennis O'Hare from American Horror Story, and we've been friends since freshman New Student Week,
wow.
And we would go to the Bistro together, and we were in a group of six. We would all go with our fake IDs, and so we went to the Bistro. I went to Le Cage. I don't know if I went to Carol's Speakeasy, although I was reading about that recently. I'm trying to think where else. But Paradise on Broadway we used to go to. I loved Chicago, and I mean, I saw Divine at Le Cage. I still can quote the act. And we would go to the Baton and see Chili Pepper, who, and you know what, I don't know what that bitch is taking, but she looks as good as she ever did and can still turn it out.
Chardonnay.
One time we were at a club and she had about four or five gays surrounding her, and she never managed to finish the story that she was saying because every 3 seconds she'd be like, bitch, let me tell you something. Whore, are you paying attention?
It was literally like, bitch, listen to this story. Whore, pay attention. I'm just going to tell you this.
She's divine. Yeah. I love her.
Well, Frank, we love you. And thank you so much for putting this book together. It's really a wonderful book.
Thank you. A little divine with a capital D and a small D.
Frank DeCaro. Yes. Is that the name? I'm not sure. I hope that they include in the audiobook all of Lady, but like they don't edit anything of it. You know, she's like, I'm not sure why you're getting me, why not giving me a break while I'm talking this? You at least bring me a glass of water.
I told her, I wrote to her, I said, Bunny, I said, I hope you had as good an experience as I did. I said, in LA, I said, there was a young kid, gay kid, with gauges in his ears, couldn't have been any cuter. And I said, oh my God, they brought me tacos. They had fresh donuts. There were muffins. I said, every 2 minutes they were feeding me again. And she's like, they didn't offer me a morsel. She didn't get anything when she did it in New York.
So
I felt bad for her.
That's terrible.
Mine was heaven. And you know, you're looking at this cute kid who's looking out for you. You know, this 20 something who's with gauges in his ears, and he's bringing you an apple so you don't sound too mushy when you're reading it. You know, and he's like, oh, it's time for taco. Oh, good, we'll eat tacos. So no, I had the damnest time in LA. They really looked out for me.
Well, do you have like any training like for your voice to, because you know, this is one thing I've noticed on our voices and a lot of people who do a lot of talk radio is that at some point in your life you start sounding like Lauren Bacall all the time.
I wish I sounded like Lauren Bacall. I would kill for a man's voice. I would love a man's voice just once in a while.
But you don't do anything like to sort of preserve your voice or keep it.
No, I talk until I'm hoarse and then I stop talking.
And then you're like, I'm
and that's just
dead.
During the week when I'm with my husband. You know, it's just, I don't know any tricks for that. And so, but it was fun when the kid was like, try an apple. He said, it'll take the slushiness out of your mouth. And he's right. You do. It fixes your saliva levels if you eat an apple. Like even a couple pieces of apple. Who knew?
Oh, wow.
But it was good. So it was very fun.
And the sugar and the apple.
Yeah. Well, then this kid was he bought the book while I was recording it. Okay. I wanted to kiss him because he's in his 20s. He's cute. But I also wanted it, and I didn't because he's got a boyfriend. I have a husband. We don't do that. However, I did think about
goodness.
It. I said, you're so cute. It's like he was adorable. But he bought my book, and then I really wanted to kiss him. You know.
Well, do you get a text message every time somebody buys your book?
No, but I wish I did. No, he just told me. He said, "Oh, I just bought your book. It'll be here on whatever." And I was like, "You're so cute."
Aww.
Can I put my tongue in the hole in your ear? I did. I never because people didn't have that out of the side of the sideshow when I was someone who dated, you know, so we didn't get that. But now it's sort of like, I can put my tongue in that. That would be interesting. But you don't, you know,
Frank,
I'm too old for that.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about the book.
This was a feast of fun. It was. Yay! I loved it.
I love it. And let's do something together. It's like I've known you for years, and it's like we have so many friends in common, and it's a shame that we just don't, you know, talk more.
Let's get together and read them to Phil. All our mutual friends would be really fun.
You're the only person that I know on the planet Earth that understands what Mark and I have gone through in the past 15 years doing this podcast.
Oh yeah, it's the hole that won't stay filled.
You know,
that's what I tell people. It's the hole that you're like, I filled this hole yesterday. You go back up, hole's empty again. You know, I'm telling you, people think, it's easy to do a podcast or a radio show. You know what it is? It's not. Okay. It's not easy.
Thank you. So, yeah. I mean, Andy Cohen, you, Johnny McGovern, Mark, and me should get together and plot something.
I think we should do is pick Andy Cohen's brain and say, how did you get this big and how do we get a piece of it too?
Well, he was the network executive. He made all the decisions. He said,
I know, good for him.
You know, he's one of those drag queens that cast themselves in the show because secretly she wanted to be the star.
Good. That's what you do. I'm telling you. It's like people want to throw shade at him. It's like that man has been so nice to me. And it's just like I am not throwing shade. It's like if I were in a position of power, I'd have given myself a talk show, too. OK, I would believe me, and it would be a lot like that show.
Having drag queens making the cocktails in the background. I wish there were a little bit more interaction with the people, the sort of the B-list celebrities in the background. Like it does feel like a little bit like you're not cool enough to sit with us kids, you know?
Still better. It's like when people say, you know, when people will say, you know, they'll talk about, that I got thin shamed when I lost weight. I had friends who still were very heavy who made fun of me.
Yeah.
And they were like, you look old now that you've lost weight. And I was just like, you know, what's better than fat shaming? Thin shaming. It's better to sit on the panel, but you know, what's better than being the bartender being the bartender better than not being the bartender. That's what I meant to say. You know, it's like, you know, I still got to be on the show and that's plenty. It's like, the man held up my book and called it the definitive history of drag and quote unquote, you know, Andy Cohen. I got everything I needed out of that and two vodka tonics. So, you know what? Fantastic. So it was great.
It's a wonderful book. Frank, thank you so much. What am I supposed to say?
Buy this goddamn book, people.
So Frank can get a
Mention the title.
This poor man is going to be living in a single room occupancy home soon. He's on food stamps.
On two coasts. No,
you have to sell one of your beach homes.
It's humble. They're in two places, but they're both humble. No, let's go. Yeah. Drag combing through the big wigs of show business by Frank DiCaro with a foreword by Bruce Valanche. There we go. Now we're done.
By Rizzoli, New York.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Oh, guys, thank you so much. This was really swell. Awesome. I love talking about me. All right. Be well. Lots of love.
Bye, Frank.
Frank DiCaro lives somewhere in New York and L.A. because he's bi-coastal. Ooh. The book is Drag, Combing Through the Big Wigs of Show Business by Frank DiCaro with a foreword by the great Bruce Valanche.
Get the book through our links in the show notes because we have a Amazon affiliate link and we'll get a little tiny profit from it. So
we're influencers before they were called influencers. Yeah, so if you go through our website, feastoffun.com, and you click on the link on the bottom right there of the entry, we get a tiny percentage of it, and the portions of the proceeds go to support the show. So the best way, you know, you can support us is get the drag book, and then when the audiobook comes out, get it. And that way you can listen to it on your, in a car or in your
Wonder what how Lady Bunny's going to handle that. Is she going to read like as Lady Bunny the other drag queens, like, or is she going to like try and imitate them? Because that'll be really funny.
I think actually Bunny can pull it off. Yeah. She does pretty good impersonations of most queens.
So. Oh my god!
Like for example, when she does RuPaul, it sounds like this.
I have a feeling maybe some of these audio might make it into some people's drag acts.
Oh yeah, this is like this is kind of remember when what is it Dolly Parton came out with a audiobook and Howard Stern edited it to make her say all sorts of nasty things, and then he played it on the show and they're like, "Ooh, Dolly, you're so filthy." Well, part of it is like, you know, Lady Bunny's really outrageous already, so it's not like you can edit the book to make her say even more outrageous things. If anything, you would edit it be like, I like Donald Trump. I think we should vote for Trump.
MSNBC does not endorse war.
It's okay by me. You know, I like all kinds of music today. It's all right.
Miley Cyrus is cool.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks for listening. Bye. Bye.